Hey everyone, it's Chantal here. Welcome to the season one finale of Everything After. At the time of recording, my whole household came down with a nasty sickness bug, which meant I was absolutely gutted to miss what I believe is a beautiful episode. Being the true professionals that we are, we couldn't let the finale pass without Tiffany and Chris bringing you this incredibly important conversation. This season, you've heard my story and Tiffany's story, but there is another voice. The person who walked every step beside us. It's a deeply vulnerable space, but it has been approached with quiet strength, gratitude, and hopefully some closure. In this episode, Tiffany sat down with her husband, Chris, to talk about what this whole journey looked like from his side. The fear, the caregiving, the unseen burden, and the love. This is a must listen for anyone who has been a patient or who has loved one. So Tiff and Chris, take it away.
Hey boo.
Hey. Hello, hello Tiffany. Thank you for having me.
Oh my gosh.
When was the last time I called you Tiffany?
It's been a minute.
It's been over 10 years, bro.
Yeah. Feels
since before we were married, I'm sure.
Yes, it feels weird to hear you say.
Yeah, probably.
So we are in the same place, but we had to go into different rooms because the audio was not working out.
Yeah, we were hearing each other twice in real life and then the actual recording.
Yes. So again, as we always say, we're doing it live. We're always doing it live. How are you feeling about today?
I feel good. I feel good. I feel a little nervous about opening up and making myself vulnerable, but I think it's important. I think you've been doing it for the past, you know, however many months it's been. So I can certainly do it. But I also think, yeah, that it's important. And it goes along with the decision we made very early on in this process to be open and to kind of talk about it and put it all out there.
Yes, we are both, I'd say we're pretty private people.
That's pretty fair to say. We didn't have a wedding because neither of us wanted to be the center of attention.
Correct. So yeah, we're pretty private, pretty, I would say, adverse to too much attention. So while this has really been the last 6 months, you know, a growing and stretching experience for me, you have like really been, you've always been the one at the forefront of like, don't hide your light, like get out there, tell your story. And so now I really am excited for people to hear your side of the story. I'm going to be completely honest. I don't really know your side of the story. Really? Like, truly? Is that fair to say?
It's weird, right? Because it's like, it's something we lived through together.
Mm-hmm.
And so because of that, we've talked about it. And more so after the case, we've sort of reflected on it, certainly, but it also has felt like, well, we lived it. We don't really have to, you know. But even though we lived it together, part of just the nature of that experience, especially considering the fact that we had a child already, like, you know, you're like sick in bed recovering from chemo or you know, in treatment or having to work, because that's still a thing you have to do throughout all of this, is like carry on with your real life, right? As if nothing is happening. And so, yeah, there's large pockets of it that stay individualized.
Yeah. Let's start at the beginning. What do you remember about the day that we found out? What was going through your mind? I will pause here to say, again, this was something I did not know until after we aired the first episode. You kind of wrote about the day I was diagnosed or the day that we kind of found out that there could be something wrong. You wrote about it in full. And that was, again, really my first time realizing, oh, wow, like there were pieces of this story that even I didn't know. So take us back. What do you remember about the day that we found out? Because it was a twofold situation. So we had June 5th, which was the day of the ultrasound. And then we had the Monday before we had the appointment with the oncologist. So I guess take us through those 3 days and from the very beginning.
Yeah. So June 5th, that's the one that looms largest to me. That's the day that they first... It wasn't the day they first found the mass. It was the day they realized how fast it was growing and started to suspect that it was something more than just a cyst, which I guess is what they had sort of assumed in the prior appointment. Anyone listening to this knows already that like we went in for what was supposed to be just a routine perinatal ultrasound, which is already not routine, the fact that we're having to do that, right? Which in retrospect, very grateful for, because it's why we caught this when we did. And I remember when the tech said, exactly the way you tell this story, where she's like, do you have a history of ovarian cysts? And you say yes. And she's just like, okay. And it like, you could just tell by the way she was asking the question and then processing the response, it just starts sending up little alarm bells, right? And then when the perinatalist was like, I'm going to send this to a friend of mine, never a good sign, right? It's like you never want them sharing what's going on with you with someone else, because that just, you're not going to do that if it's something routine or like normal, right? So yeah, that was the hardest day, because in part, knowing there was something but not knowing what it was, suddenly your mind is filling in the blanks with like the worst possible outcomes. And I know that when they said they were sending you to an oncologist, then I was like, so they think it's cancer. And sort of your reaction to that sort of told me like, okay, you need to stop. And you need to kind of step back, which what admittedly in the moment felt very isolating. Even though I totally understand, right? Mm-hmm. As scary as that is for me to think about, you're the one who is facing this thing happening to you and like inside your body, right?
Yeah.
And
yeah.
And also with a child that you are incubating. And that was when you sort of went off in the room by yourself. We're surrounded by like my mom, my aunt, who God bless them, are so great in general, but also ask a lot of questions and like questions we don't know why are they doing this? Why are they doing this before they do this? We don't know, right? Stop asking us these questions, like whatever. I sort of was doing everything in my power not to Google cancer or like ovarian cancer. And we knew it was on the ovary. So like that's sort of kind of immediately where you go, right?
Yes.
And I'm sort of I'm a
hypochondriac.
Yes. Yeah. A Google self-diagnoser. I've convinced, if it's a disease that exists, I've convinced myself that I have it at some point. And I didn't want to do that, but at some point I did that. I don't remember when that broke. I think at some point I just kind of had to like, I don't know, face
and, but
it.
Then when you Google like ovarian cancer, like none of the results are positive.
None of the results are good.
It's always the worst possible thing.
Yes. Yeah. It's like because like the survival rate is, it's all like bad.
Yeah.
And I remember, I think it was this day, my mom, of course, was like texting her sisters. I just remember, I don't know what it said. I just remember her getting one text from one particular sister, and her and my aunt looked at each other and were like, why would she say that? So I'm sure it was something about like, oh, everyone dies from that one or something, you know, something completely unhelpful. But yeah, so when I was writing about it, I described the feeling as like straddling a bottomless pit. And like there is a like balloon tied to one end of you trying to pull you up away from everything and like completely disassociate. And then there's a boulder tied to your other end trying to pull you into that pit. Because it's like in a moment like that, especially as we're waiting for like, what is this? What's going on? You feel stuck between wanting to disconnect and sort of lock yourself in your own fear, and but also you have to be kind of present. And so then at some point, you know, you think the word, you let yourself think cancer, or you let yourself think about whatever, you know. And it's like that, the rope holding the balloon gets cut, and suddenly you just get pulled into that pit. And you're falling down a bottomless pit, and projected on the walls around you as you fall are like every possible outcome, right? So I just remember a moment where I let myself think ovarian cancer, and it's suddenly I could see like a million different paths forward from that. Many of which in that moment involved losing you. Like that was something that suddenly I had to think about in a very real way.
Yeah.
And that is horrifying on its own, right? And just like the feelings of like fear and even spiraling out from that to like, you know, I'm going to have to raise children on my own. It's not the kind of stuff maybe you should be thinking in that moment, but you also can't help yourself. I just distinctly remember thinking, oh, I don't want people to like pity or feel sorry for me. Like I just had a vision of how people were going to react to the news. Mm. And it was like, I don't want to have to bear the brunt of that.
Yeah.
And so there was just a lot. And then getting the call from your OB, who was on vacation, but called you. And that was when I knew like, oh, this is bad. She's calling right now, you know, she's on vacation, she's calling, this isn't good. And she knows it's not good based on whatever she's hearing. And then like the quickness with which they scheduled that follow-up with the oncologist, which was good that they were moving so fast, but was also an indication of how serious it was. We were still telling ourselves, like, we don't know what it is. It could be nothing. It could just be a cyst or whatever. But, yeah, it really was just sort of this moment of complete terror at, like, the unknown. So that's the big day, you know? Like, it's weird because when we actually got the diagnosis, that was hard. And I remember we both just, when you told me, you like pulled me into the kitchen to tell me, and we both just like held on to each other and cried. Mm-hmm. But it was also like, because I had also indulged in the worst fears earlier, it was like I had gotten through that part. There was always a part of me that was like, well, I think this is going to be okay because we caught it so early. And it doesn't mean that there weren't still moments throughout the whole process where I was thinking the worst, right? Because, you know, you never know. Did it spread before we caught, you know? That's always sort of looming over you. But yeah, it was that first day was like, there was no diagnosis yet, but that feels like it was diagnosis day.
Yes, I agree. I agree. That day, I think, always really plays out in my mind as the day because it was all those questions. Like you said, it was, okay, there's clearly something wrong. You're referring me to a GYN oncologist. You're rushing me to an MRI. Right, there are all of these things. Everybody is calling me.
You're telling us immediately that you're going to cut this thing out, even though you're pregnant. Like, there's no question. I mean, there was, they did actually give us the choice, but it was clear that like they wanted to get it out as quickly as possible.
Yes, yes. And I, and to their credit, like none of them presented as worried. I think you and I are just naturally anxious people. I think we both have like very high functioning anxiety. And so none of them presented as we are worried about this. If anything, I think we both were kind of like, well, why aren't y'all more worried about this?
Yeah. Yeah. You know, whenever I'm on a plane and there's like really bad turbulence, I always watch the flight attendants. Mm-hmm. Because I know that if they're not reacting to it, it's probably nothing. But if they're reacting to something, then I know it's probably. And it was a similar thing with your whole team. You know, I mean, part of it was just that your oncologist, he just blows in and out like a hurricane, and he's so full of swagger that, like, even if you know it had been serious, it probably would have. He would have, you know, treated it like it was nothing. But the rest of the team too, and I even remember. Betsy, I'll shout out Betsy by name. Who was one of the members of the staff. I think this was maybe after the surgery when she was going through the specific chemo regimen and like side effects and everything. But I remember her just kind of at one point saying, it felt like sort of an aside, her just going, it's going to be okay.
Yeah.
You're going to be okay. Obviously she's not going to say, oh, we're going to cure you, it's going to be fine, because you don't want to like make, they're never going to make that promise. But it was just very clear that they felt like this was very manageable and that you would come out the other side okay. And it was very early on in the process that he kept saying like, oh, well, we're going to cure her. Like, you're going to be cured. It's going to be.
Which she would always be like, okay,
she would
down.
Be the one. Yeah.
It's always helpful when like the most nonplussed person on the team is like, okay, chill out. Like, yeah. we can give her hope, but come on, let's be right. Realistic here.
Yeah.
I often say like this pregnancy was really supposed to be our, you know, our like second chance to have a normal pregnancy, because our first pregnancy was during COVID. It also was very, very, very traumatic. And how did you hold the excitement of us expecting a new baby with the weight of what was happening at the same time?
It feels bad to say this. But I don't know if I was really able to feel much excitement. I've thought of this, and I think we've talked about it. I don't know that I really sort of had reckoned yet myself with the extent to which the second pregnancy feels like it was stolen from us. 'Cause like the first one, yeah, it was a COVID pregnancy. I wasn't able to go to any of the appointments. It ended in such a traumatic and dramatic fashion. But it's also like we knew we were pregnant during COVID. Like we went into that one knowing that like, okay, it's COVID. This is going to be different. It's going to be sort of, I don't know if compromise is the right word, but we're not going to be able to like share it with people or, you know, we're not going to be able to like go out and walk around with you and your baby bump and get all that sort of, even though we said we don't like attention, get that sort of good attention to sort of get from that experience. And yeah, this one felt like our second chance. And then suddenly, you know, early on, it's like, nope. And it's not that I wasn't excited. It was just hard. I think it was hard to hold space for any other feeling beyond the worry or just making sure that you were being taken care of, or just being so busy managing that and also sort of managing having an almost 3-year-old, you know? So yeah, it feels bad. And I don't know. I don't think we've ever talked about this aspect. So I don't know, like, for you, if you were able to even hold any excitement, like, not even just emotionally, but even like physically, did you even have the energy for that?
I mean, it was like, for me, the thing that really kept me going, you know, because I approached being pregnant with Gabe a lot differently than I did with Sammy, in that I shared with like friends and colleagues pretty much like as soon as I saw those two lines that I was pregnant. It was just very early. It was just very, very early on in the pregnancy that I shared, which is not something I would normally do or think to do. I think with Sammy, we told our super close friends, super close family. And then I think one day, I think the day he was born, I popped up online and was like, oh, we had a baby.
Yeah. Well, that was also, I mean, that was also because we had lost a pregnancy. So we were very cautious about doing that too early.
Whereas being pregnant the first time with Sammy, most of the pregnancy was pretty easy until it wasn't towards the end. And so I knew that I wanted to let people in, I guess, on the quote unquote journey a lot sooner, because people did really rally around us, with Sammy being premature and it being COVID. And so I did at least want to include a lot of those people into this good news. So all that to say, I still felt like excitement about him being here, about like meeting him. And I do just think because a lot of my treatment revolved around him. He was just always on the top of my mind. And he was kind of like the reward at the end of all of this to me. And so I could not wait for September 15th to get here, because I think I was up that morning, like ready to go. Like, let's go. Let's get this show on the road. Because I was excited to meet him, because it did just feel like this is the reward for getting through all of this. And I wanted him to be done with it. Like, I wanted him to be done with this part of the process. And so the excitement never left me. And I think it's because it was the thing that kept me going.
I think that for me, and again, not that I wasn't looking forward to it, but like in terms of like just that visceral excitement you get to feel every day when you're expecting a child, I think it's like I had to sort of use that energy and kind of reallocate it to, well, I need to make sure he gets here and that he's okay, right? And which even though they were very clear very early on about, like, you know, the chemo's not gonna go through the placenta, it's not gonna affect him, there is still that part of you that's like, well, really, like, are you sure? Like, because I see it killing everything else,
right?
Like, in her body, and like very viciously attacking every component of her except that, which was true, because he was, my goodness, like beyond okay.
Yeah.
So yeah, I don't know. I don't know how much of that too was just that, like, I didn't have time to think about it. Like, for you, you were obviously living with that every single second. And for me, it was like, well, I had to kind of take care of everything else. I still had to work full time. I had to sort of not just take care of Sammy, but also, you know, do that thing of trying to like protect him from what was going on, you know, a little bit, or contextualize it for him.
That's actually a good segue, because that's actually my next question. So, you're setting me up very good.
I'm a pro.
You are a pro. So we already had Sammy, and he was 2, going on 3 at the time, and you were getting into it. So what do you remember about balancing parenting, caregiving, and just surviving the whole thing? Like, this took up a large part of 2023 for us. Like, I think June to like
to December
really. So what was that like? Is that Roscoe in the background?
It is Roscoe in the background, click clacking his little claws. Well, first of all, it's crazy that it was, it's actually, you say it took up most of the year, and yeah, but it's also crazy that it was only June to, that it was only 6 months. That's insane.
I know.
Because it feels like it was years. I don't know. I don't know if I did balance it. You know, like I don't even know if I was thinking about balancing so much as I was just thinking about like surviving or getting through it. And it really does just become a thing of like, okay, well, I have to do this and this, and like, here's what has to be done, and I'm just going to do it. So I don't know. I wish I had a more sort of concrete and helpful answer to that. It really, I think, just becomes a matter of sort of giving yourself over to the whole thing and understanding that, like, well, okay, this is just what life is for right now. I do feel like when I think back, sometimes it does feel like you have PTSD from it a little bit, you know? To where, you know, it doesn't really feel like you're responding to it as like a constant trauma in the moment because you're so caught up in it. But then I think back and it's like so much of it is a blur or is kind of indistinct. And I think it is because you're having like a trauma response to it. Where your body is kind of like, I don't know if autopilot is the right word exactly. But I also feel like there's also a part of me that has been thinking like, thank God we had the other kid. Thank God I was so busy during that time, because it's like, you're too busy to think about it, you know?
Yeah.
Which also is not great, because it means that when it does bubble up and you do kind of have to contend with it, it comes on hard, and it's, you know, so I don't, yeah. That's the kind of stuff that like I've been unpacking, I think, ever since. I think it is just a matter of putting one foot in front of the other and knowing, you know, okay, well, I have to step here first. I've got to do this. I got to do this. I just don't know how else you would do it. It's hard, yeah, because like people will ask you like, well, how did you do that? How did you get through that? How did you survive it? And it's kind of like, I don't know. I just did. Like, because you have no other choice. And honestly, too, though, I think that having had a child was also kind of, in a way, preparation for it. Because so much of parenthood, especially in those first few months, it's all about like, okay, I don't exist as a person, basically.
Yes.
Like,
yes.
My life right now is feed, change, pump, clean pump parts, shove food in my mouth for 30 seconds if I can at one point, sleep for, you know, an hour and a half whenever I can here and there, and then just like rinse, wash, and repeat. I think having gone through the boot camp of parenthood, in a way, I think prepares you for that.
I know we shouted her out at the beginning of this episode, but like, shout out to your mom and shout out to your aunt. Your aunt really jumped in, picking up, picking up Sammy from school, coming some mornings to pick him up to drop him off, especially mornings where I had chemo and we couldn't, you know, figure out, like, how did you find support look like for you and for us just as a family?
Biggest thing to, or the thing that resonated with me most was the sort of quiet or silent support, you know. I mean, I was going to say all the small gestures, but those small gestures become huge, right? I think that something else that really helped us was that we also had friends who had been through similar circumstances, right? Like two of our best friends who are a couple, each lost people to cancer. And so they knew like what was helpful and what wasn't, and were able to kind of guide us through that. So like having a friend like Robin, I'll shout her out by name too, having a friend like Robin who could say, hey, let me set up a meal train for you, because what's great about it is people can sign up, they can drop off food, you don't have to do anything, you don't have to talk to them, you know. It's neither of you feel the burden of having to like meet and have a conversation, you know. It can just be a simple thing. And also having someone like that, people like that, to sort of understand what it's like to be a caregiver.
Yeah.
And to have someone say, your mom said this too to me early on, was, you know, make sure you're taking care of yourself.
Mm-hmm.
It's going to feel like you can't, and it's going to feel like you're being selfish, but you have to. You have to, otherwise you're going to burn out, or you're going to get bitter, or this and this. You're also just not going to be able to be the version of yourself that you need to be in order to take care of her. And so having that sort of permission was huge.
Yeah.
Or what felt like permission. Yeah, so it really just, it still blows me away, like the amount of people who did that, and to the extent that certain people did it. Dropping off food or donating money or whatever it was. Picking up the kids, you know, visiting for a weekend to watch the kids.
Yeah.
Or like help clean our house or whatever it was. It just really, it kind of just shows you that support sometimes is just being there.
Yeah.
You know, it doesn't have to be like these huge grand sweeping gestures or like having these probing conversations about like, well, how are you? How are you feeling? You know, it can just be like, hey, I'm going to come do the dishes, or I'm going to drop off a meal, or.
Which is so great. I mean, we really lucked out in the fact that both you and I just have incredible colleagues who are also friends, you know. And so I just remember, like, if they couldn't drop off food, I saw them donating money to the meal train, you know, like I saw them.
Yeah, yeah.
And not that I was keeping tabs on stuff like that, but
it
is like, you know, all of the people who we spend most of our time with, because that's where most of us spend our time, is at work, truly, truly stepped in and just made it so, so easy. I still tell my coworker of like, girl, I need you to, I got to get sick again so you can make me that chicken, because that chicken was delicious.
Yeah, with the pepperoncini, like the,
yes.
Yeah.
But it was just simple acts of like, and my colleagues, only one of them lives within maybe like spitting distance of us, but everybody else all over the city, you know? So people driving down, you know, two of our closest friends, our oldest friends here in the city, driving down 85, up and down 85 multiple times to bring us a meal, like a hot meal. I know what that is like, because if you live in Atlanta, you know this traffic is god awful. And so if you're willing to get into traffic just to drop off a meal at my front door and then leave, like, that's love. That is an act of care. Like, people who we hadn't talked to in a couple years, but who we used to work with, you know, when they found out, like, donated money or, you know, dropped off food, asked, you know, we're checking in. And the support was really, really phenomenal. Like, I'm still in awe just by the level of support. And it's been now 2 years, you know. It's not until something like this happens that you're like, wow, y'all really do like me.
Yeah, I know. And it's hard because you saying this, it's, I imagine people listening to this and being like, well, yeah, of course. Why are you surprised? Like, of course we would have done, like, what are you talking about? But there is, it is, you know, it's just, you can't understand how much that means until you're in it. And until you feel just that influx at like your darkest moment. It really just means the world. Yeah.
Yeah. Were there moments where you felt helpless or unsure of what to say? Like, because I think we tried to really have a baseline of communication between the two of us, even though there were just some days where I just could not, you know, like I don't think I've ever even really asked you about your experiences on the days that you did come to chemo with me, or like not being able to come to chemo with me because you had to, like, all these things were going on, but we've never like touched on it until now.
Yeah. Yeah, I think I felt helpless every second that it was going on, but certainly, like, you know, like when you were having an allergic reaction in the chemo chair, or like on a day when you were having really bad side effects, like when you were having neuropathy especially, days like that, or when you were just really laid low, were the times that I did feel especially helpless. I remember too, of a very distinct memory of being in bed one morning, and Sammy came into the room and was on like some little toy car and was just doing the absolute most. And it was early, and you didn't feel good. And I just remember you breaking down and saying, "He just wants to play." And like, you know, I could tell like the guilt you were feeling for not being able to like play with him, or for not being able to have like a normal morning with him or whatever. And yeah, I could say, well, of course it's not your fault, the this and that. But it doesn't mean you're not going to feel that, you know, like that guilt is not going to just be assuaged by words. You know, I also, yeah, this was never a conscious conversation we had, I don't think, but I sort of, part of it was just knowing you, and part of it was understanding enough, sort of maybe on an intuitive level, what would be helpful and what wouldn't be helpful in a situation like that. But I felt like for me, my job was just kind of like, was largely to be there. Mm. So like, you know, we don't have to talk about, you know, chemo or treatment plans while we're sitting next to each other in a chemo suite, in an infusion center.
Right.
Right. You just want to be able to sit there and watch your shows or read your book or whatever it was. If this can be as normal as possible, within the context of how very not normal it is, you know, so it's just like we're laying in bed next to each other, watching TV or reading, we're just doing it in a hospital chair. You know, that was sort of my approach to it, which I think was, if we had talked about it, I'm sure would have been the one you would have preferred, rather than sort of like fussing over, how are you feeling? How you do? Because even like, how are you feeling would sometimes feel like burdening you with having to contextualize.
Yes, because how do you think I'm feeling?
Yeah, exactly. That, but also like me asking that, even if you're not doing it consciously for this reason, asking how you're doing is like putting the burden on you of contextualizing what you're going through for me. So that just felt, that didn't feel helpful or productive to, and I could see how you were doing. I could see when you felt bad or when you were in better shape or better spirits. Yeah, so that was sort of how I approached it.
Yeah, that time was, I mean, I had kind of forgotten about that Sammy story, but so it just brought back kind of like a swarm of feelings about that time. Because I felt helpless just as a mom, just as a partner. I felt like I wasn't, you know, pulling my weight, quote unquote, you know, like doing my part, even though in that moment, now I know my part was getting better.
Yeah.
It was hard at the time not to internalize my illness as a failure and not to like feel, oh, I'm just failing everybody because I can't really play with my kid. I can't get on the floor. Like I have to sleep in a separate room a week at a time because, you know, my blood counts are low. Like my immune system is compromised. Like nothing made me feel more helpless than when I think Sammy had got like hand, foot, mouth. And I think Gabe was like maybe like 2 weeks old. And it was just like having to be separate from everybody because I think I had just finished chemo. I was already immunocompromised and just everybody's sick and you're the one having to manage it all, like manage the fallout of us all being sick and also so keeping your wife who has cancer away from the kid who has hand, foot, and mouth and then also keeping the newborn away from the kid that has hand, foot, and mouth. It was just so that for me, when it started to become like cold and flu season, that for me became like where I felt the most helpless because I couldn't do much. And then I remember I had a conversation when this was maybe like last year with my therapist of just feeling like I lost time with Sammy. Like that's just 6 months of his life that I feel like I was just a complete like non-entity in, you know, it still doesn't make me feel any better about it. Especially at the time, I think when I was sharing this in therapy at the time, like he was just having just a really, really challenging behavior problems. Where now we know that was just him being a three-nager and was all developmentally appropriate, but it was just also just like really hard because I blame myself of like, well, is it the fact that, you know, he had to watch a tablet for 6 months because none of us could really take care of him, you know,
yeah,
like
yeah.
All the things, all the scenarios in my head of we did this because we were going through this. And so this is why that is happening. Whereas now I know like we were all just in survival mode.
Yeah. Yeah, and it's. I think it's hard too. And obviously, it's not. You shouldn't feel. I'm like, and I can say that you're still gonna feel it anyway. It's hard. Well, like one something that I've very much learned about parenthood is that a core component of it is just feeling bad about things, even if you shouldn't feel bad about them. You're gonna feel bad about them, and you're always gonna wonder like, God, is the way I reacted to this one thing because I was tired or in a bad mood? And so much of that is just how we frame illness in this culture. But yeah, I think it's also hard too because, you know, like I was saying earlier, it's like you try to do your best to kind of like shield him or insulate him from what's going on. But, you know, lately we've gotten indications of like, well, he kind of knows on some level what was going on. Or if he can't pinpoint and say, oh, mommy had cancer, but he'll say things like, I didn't like it when mommy lost her hair, you know?
Yeah.
So like he has an intuitive emotional sense of what was going on. And yeah, so it's really hard to not worry or wonder what effect that's having on him. Part of the other job of parenthood, whether we like it or not, is that, well, now it's our job to contextualize that for him and sort of fold that into his development. And you know, that's probably in the long run going to make him a more empathetic person or will equip him to better understand what someone's going through and take care of them, which he's already so good at anyway. But yeah, that dimension of it it's funny because it makes total sense that you would feel that way. about your relationship with him during that time, I look back at that time and it's like, well, that feels like when we were closest, you know, because we were just together so much.
Mm-hmm.
It really was just kind of the two of us ostensibly for a while. That's like the one sort of like bright spot of thinking back on that time is like the amount and the intensity of time that I got with him.
Yeah. Is there a moment that still stands out to you, or I guess one that shifted how you saw me or us?
I think that big picture wise, what something like this does is it really makes you think in a concrete way about the extent to which someone that you love, someone that you admire and like look up to is mortal, you know? And I don't even necessarily mean that, or like mortal and fallible. Like, I don't even necessarily mean that in like a girl boss way, you know, but even just on a basic level of like, oh, this person, and some of this just comes from how young we were when this happened. You know,
I'm just kidding.
Okay. Unfair. we're not that far. Now people are going to think, you know, we're not that far apart. I was on the other side of 40, just barely, just, you know, months, past 40. But, you know, young enough that we weren't thinking about that. I didn't consciously feel like I had to think about what will happen when my spouse dies. You know, what will that be like? And even though, yes, it was clear to us pretty early on that we were probably going to be okay on the other end of this, health-wise, at least, or that you were going to be. It gives you a really visceral reminder that none of this is permanent and that you can't take it for granted. I'm not just, like, saying this, but, like, you loom very large in my mind. It is that thing of, like, you know, because of how you feel about someone or the degree to which you, like, love and admire someone, they feel like a colossus. Right. And I remember this wasn't the cancer. This was when you had the fibroid surgery. I remember when when that was done and they were taking you to your room and they brought me into the hallway and they wheeled you out of the elevator and you just looked so small in that bed. I remember two things stick out to me. I don't know if this directly ties to the question, but two things that do stick out to me as sort of reframe moments. When we went into, or maybe when we were going into that first oncology appointment, and you said to me, if it comes down to it, I want you to make sure the baby lives. If you have to choose between the two of us, choose the baby. And I remember just thinking, oh, fuck, I am not ready to make that choice. I will do it if that's what you want. If that is your wish, I will honor it. But please, God, let that not be the choice. That made it, not that it wasn't already real, but that made it like very real to me.
Yeah.
And then I remember, I don't remember if it was after that appointment or if it was after one of the appointments after we had gotten the official diagnosis, but we're driving out of the parking lot of the hospital and we're just like holding hands and you were just like, it's not fair. And that was, I remember that being another moment. Because one, no, it wasn't. I mean, it's never, none of it's fair, but, you know, but it wasn't fair for a variety of reasons. Because you were so young, because we were expecting a second child, because we already had a child, because we were, you know, still in the beginnings, you know, the extended beginning of our life together, not the ends of it. But that was also another moment where, like, the stakes crystallized for me of like, yeah, it's not fair. And I think those two moments stand out because those were the moments I can't think of a concrete instance where we had a conversation of like, you might not live, or, you know, like, but those were the two moments where it felt like you were acknowledging, oh, I might not make it through this.
Mm. Yeah. Because, I mean, those were very real thoughts. I have said it before, like, we didn't know what stage I was until I delivered. Yeah. So that still was something that loomed in my mind. And I joke all the time, it's like, I never really had a reference of what a cancer diagnosis while you're pregnant look like. The only reference I ever had was Grey's Anatomy. We all got our, you know, our medical degree on Grey's Anatomy. And the only reference that I had was that it was a choice. It was a choice that the mother had to make. And so I knew very early on going in that if it was down to the decision of, you know, me or Gabe, I was comfortable making the choice that it was always going to be him. Even knowing that, like, there was a real potential that Sammy could grow up without me. But that is at the time, that is really where my heart was. I knew that where I was in the pregnancy was far along enough that he would, for the most part, be able to live a full life. He would, like, had he been taken at 24, 25 weeks, he still had his odds of surviving were still very, very good. And so, I don't know. I think about that time of just, like, that was my instinct of, I've lived my life. I felt comfortable that if something were to happen to me, and I still feel comfortable if something were to ever happen to me, like, you are more than capable of, like, raising our sons. And so I knew that they would always be in good hands.
And you know, when you said that, like, it was sort of like, on the one hand, it was like, well, of course. That makes total sense. And that would be the decision, I think, for both of us if it had to come to that. I just didn't want it to. And I didn't want to think about the fact. And I had, now, I, part of what I had to contend with was like, well, you have to think about this stuff. Mm-hmm. Because, like, it's a real possibility. We're in it. And you have to, you know, you have to contend with what you don't want to contend with because you have no other choice. And it was also, but it's also just like, I don't know, so much of this is also colored by the fact that, like, we're on the other side of it, and Gabe is now 2 years old, but it always felt like, well, he's supposed to be here, you know, like, it was like, he is meant to be here. And that is kind of like, whatever, everything else is sort of secondary to that.
Yeah. So when this episode airs, it will be November 13th, which in our household is a very, very special day. It is special because that is the day that Samuel was born. And it is also special because it'll mark 2 years since I rang the bell. When you look at us now, 2 years later, from that bell ringing day, what feels most different?
I think that what feels most different, aside from the fact that, like, I look at pictures of us before and I think, oh,
we old as hell.
Look at those kids. And then I look at pictures of us now and I think, oh, those are like capital A adults. Some of that's just years. Some of that is just what we've been through in the last, you know, because even before Sammy, like with the miscarriage and the fibroid, like it's what that's like. That's a 7-year journey now.
Yeah.
At this point. That's a very heavy and other things that have happened over the last 7 years, like, you know, things we've been through and people we've lost. It's just a lot of growing up that has been sort of foisted upon us. But I think what feels most different is that the other thing I see in those old pictures and videos are two kids who are sort of afraid and sheepish and not quite willing or ready to own like their lives and who they are. And I think that now we've both kind of taken charge of who we are and who we want to be and what we want to do. And I think some of that is just getting older and getting into that effort era of life. But a lot of it, I think, if not most of it, comes down to having been through this experience and having come face to face with how tenuous and fleeting it all is and how quickly it can all change or potentially be taken away from you. And it's like, well, why wouldn't you live your life? Well, you know, why would you say no to things knowing that? Why would you not go to Iceland for a weekend if the opportunity presents itself, you know? Why would you not go to the festival, even if it's gonna be like a pain or there's gonna be logistic things to figure out? There's no reason to not do it.
Yeah.
So that's what feels the most changed.
I would agree. We talked about this last night over dinner. Like, I feel like this year being 2025, I have just allowed myself to be a little selfish. And I know that I could not and would not be able to do that without having you as a partner. You know, like, you've kind of been, we've been together, what? 13 years.
13 years.
Yeah. 13 years total.
We've 13 years this month, which we actually didn't.
We did not celebrate.
Acknowledge or celebrate. We got so caught up in other things.
Yes.
But yeah, October 20th, 2012.
Yeah. So we've been together for 13 years. We've been married. We just celebrated 10 years in January. And I know that. Like, I know that you know that the last 2 years has just been extremely difficult, you know, between cancer diagnosis, treatment, recovery, losing my dad, who, you know, you also love dearly. So I knew this year was the year that if, as my mom always says, if the Lord said the same, that this was going to be the year that I would take time to just really get back to myself. You know, I thought that was what last year was going to be like, but last year actually it was a lot harder than I thought it was going to be because I was grieving. I was on those maintenance pills that just really mess with my appetite so much and just made me still feel like I was in doing chemotherapy, just not sitting in an infusion center. And so I have just been so, I've taken the time to care about me, like the mental, physical aspects of myself this year. And I can't stress enough just how grateful I am, even though I know that you're giving me the opportunity and the space to do that. But I know that it is also coming at a season for you where you are busy and you are, you're still having to put things sometimes on the back burner or take on more. But all that to say is that I appreciate you allowing me to have this time this year to truly rediscover this new me, because I'm relearning myself, because I'm not the same person I was when I stepped into that chemo chair the very first time.
Yeah, you're not just relearning yourself. You are doing that, but you're also finally allowing yourself to become the version of you that you were always meant to be. Is also in large part what's happening. And, you know, this feels like the first year since 2018, maybe, that you have been able to be your full self, that you haven't been getting an operation or growing life inside of you or undergoing treatment or grieving a like huge loss. So I mean, I don't know. That's the job. That's the vow, you know? Like that's what I agreed to. That's, you know, and that door's going to swing both ways, or that pendulum's going to swing back in the other direction at some point. Where like, you know, part of it also too though is you know, especially being in a partnership where there's children and both people are very busy. It's not the same as caregiving or going through cancer treatment, but it's similar to what I said earlier about like, you gotta find where to put your feet and you gotta figure out where the stuff you're moving is going. You just got to do it because you don't have any other. There's no other. You either got to do it or you don't do it. If not doing it feels like an option that would be disrespecting everything that you have been through and that we've been through together.
What do you hope people who are loving someone through cancer take from hearing you?
I think that the biggest thing I would want someone to take away is that you don't have to know what you're doing. You know, you don't have to have it figured out. Your job is not to figure it out or have all the answers. That's what the doctors are for. That's what therapy's for. You know, like your job is to be there and to be present, whatever that means for you, whatever that means for the other person. Because again, different people going through cancer or treatment are going to have different needs, or they're going to have different ways that they want support to manifest. You don't have to know what you're doing. You don't have to be ready for it. You don't have to feel like you need to be ready for it. You just have to be, you have to be there. You have to be open, and you have to be, willing and able to attune yourself to what the needs are in any given moment. And you have to be easy on yourself when you feel like you're failing.
Yeah. That's good. That's good, Chris Saylor.
Like I said, I'm a pro.
As we wrap up, I just want to thank you for taking the time to come and chat today.
To come all the way to our playroom.
Yes. I know that Chantel wishes that she could have been here. And I hope I did the interview justice today.
I think so.
Tell the people where they can find you. Drop all the socials, all the whatevers.
Oh, yeah. Goodness. Okay. So you can find me Alexa decided to chime in there. Alexa doesn't know how to help me with that.
Hey, girl. Hey.
You can find me at Substack. It's Chris Saylor with two S's at Substack.com. You can also just look for Christopher Saylor, Substack. Everywhere else, any other social media that I'm on, I'm Chris Saylor with one S. One word, one S. Mainly Instagram. I'm on Blue Sky, but I don't really use it. Yeah, Chris Saylor, one word, one S, anywhere else.
We'll drop it in the show notes.
Yeah, we'll drop it in the show.
Yes. Thank you again for joining me today. There's just something different about hearing this part of the story said out loud, even though we lived every single second of it together. And like I said earlier, I know that Chantel wishes that she could have been here for this one, but she will be back next episode when we drop our bonus reflection and also talk about the differences in the healthcare system. And that will be the true close to season one. So thanks for listening. Thanks for walking through every twist and turn with us. And thank you for sharing your own stories along the way. I am Tiffany. And as always, this is everything after. Click.
Now, I'm not going to try to do Chantel's part of that because I don't think I'll do it as well. Can I do one thing before we sign off? Can
yes,
I do a girl?
Please.
Can I do a girl?
Sure.
Girl.
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 Girl. You can put that in the interstitials. You don't have to make that.
Okay. All right.
I just had to do it before. Yeah, of course.
Okay.
All right. All right. I'll see you. Love you. I'll see you in like 10 seconds.
Okay. Bye.
Bye.
So there you have it. Wow. That was such a beautiful, powerful conversation. I laughed, and yes, I literally cried. So editing this one definitely took me a little longer than usual, but it was worth every second. I'm absolutely in awe of how Tiffany and Chris shared such a unique story and captured a side that many people might never think about, the immense weight carried by the caregiver. Hearing Chris describe that feeling of helplessness and then Tiffany reflect on the guilt, it just hits home. And that moment about Sammy, so relatable. And Tiff, hearing you both talk about the choice to choose the baby, that is a line that will forever stick in my mind. On a lighter note, Chris, if you ever want to take my closing credits on a future episode so you can say girl, you absolutely have my permission. Thank you both for trusting us with this story. Tiffany and I will be back soon with a bonus episode to officially close out the season. So until then, this is Everything After.